last year and watched his seat go to Republican Governor John Hoeven. In addition, the state's lone House seat was also won by the GOP. Last week, one other senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison, a Texas Republican, announced her retirement for 2012. With 23 Democratic and just 10 Republican seats up next year, the GOP is optimistic about gaining control of the Senate. Ken Rudin, NPR News, Washington.
The mayor of Camden, New Jersey, is addressing government workers this hour in an effort to quell anger over deep budget cuts that take effect today. Several police officers have already turned in their badges, and firefighters are planning a demonstration to protest the cuts. The crime-ridden city's police force is expected to be cut in half. About a third of Camden's firefighters are expected to lose their positions. Camden is struggling with a massive deficit. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Fresh Air, Australian actress Jackie Weaver talks about playing the matriarch of a criminal family who has a twisted relationship with her boys.
It is an inappropriate gesture to kiss your adult son lingeringly on the mouth.
And we talk with David Michaud, who wrote the role for Weaver and directed the film Animal Kingdom. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Burlingame Home Inspection and Performance. Burlingame performs property inspections along with energy audits and ratings for Energy Star, tax credits, and efficiency mortgages, all utilizing infrared technology. More information is at CUSaveEnergy.com or 217-649-1173.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producer for the show, Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is at the controls right at the moment. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about animal rights. People all over the world believe that humans should treat our fellow animals with compassion. At the same time, the very question of whether animals have rights is very contentious. Paul Waldow, a leading authority on the subject, our guest for this morning, says that polarization need not be the dominant feature of this debate. He says the dominant feature is the common question, what is the meaning of life? In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Paul Waldow. He is the former director of the Center for Animals and Public Policy at Tufts University. He was there between 2004 and 2008. He is currently president of the Religion and Animals Institute. His academic training is in the areas of philosophy and law. He has authored a number of books. He's taught ethics courses at the vet school there at Tufts for a number of years. In 2010, he was, again, as he has for a number of years now, been named the Barker Lecturer in Animal Law at Harvard Law School, where he first taught the course in 2002. He has also taught at Yale Law School and also Boston College Law School. And he is the author of a recent book that explores some of the basic questions here. And we'll try to talk about some of them. The title of his book is Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know. It is published by the Oxford University Press and is a part of a series of books that they call the Need to Know series. And so you might want to go out and take a look at that. I'm sure it's available in the bookstore. The questions are welcome, too, if you'd like to call in. We hope that people can be on the topic and can try to be brief, but we really welcome people into the show. Questions, comments, are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we do have the email. If you'd like to send along your comment that way, you can do that. Write us at will-talk. That's just like it sounds, W-I-L-L-talk at illinois.edu. And Dr. Waldo, hello.
Hello, David. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks for talking with us. And I just wanted to talk, by the way, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Good, good, very good. I thank you very much for being with us. And, you know, I think in going into the subject, I thought this was something that it's a good thing to discuss, to get people to think about what they think about the whole issue of animal rights. And at the same time, I have to be honest and say I approach the issue with a little bit of trepidation, just because while I think there is something of a continuum, if you look at the way people feel, people draw lines different places. It does seem, as you say, that the conversation here about animal rights tends to be dominated by the loudest voices, and those are the people who are at the extremes, which makes it seem that it's a difficult thing to actually have a conversation about. And maybe that's a place to start, because you make the argument that it needn't be a polarizing conversation, even though it seems that as we talk about it, it becomes more and more polarized all the time.
Well, I think you're right. It is a very good thing to discuss, especially because it's a polarized topic. In preparation for the book, I have literally talked to hundreds, perhaps thousands of people around the world, and I'm aware that I think many of us are aware that polarization is an element, but many people embrace this wholeheartedly. There are lots of different versions of it. There are spiritual versions and secular versions. It's a very ancient topic. It's also a very modern topic in its own way. And it seems to me those kinds of topics are healthy to get in our democracy on the table, and to have a table at which there are a lot of different kinds of people sitting, people of religious communities, scholars, activists, business individuals, and all kinds of people. So I really appreciate the chance to talk about the book on NPR.
Yeah, I think you make right off a point that's worth acknowledging, and that is if you look around the world and you look across time, you find that people have fairly consistently felt that many people have felt that animals were special, that animals, that humans had a special kind of relationship with other animals, and that they thought about what was the proper way to treat them, and in fact that, generally speaking, that people believe that animals should be treated humanely, with compassion. Now we're talking about animal rights in a way that they haven't really been discussed before, at least maybe not before 100 years ago or so. What do you think is there something about the conversation that we're having now that sets it apart from this long tradition of talking about animal welfare and the need to treat animals humanely?
Yes, I think there is. The modern version, of course, is an outgrowth of the really deep ancient roots. Every religious tradition has in its deepest roots these concerns. The modern version, of course, has been really supercharged by discussion about the legal rights possibilities here. Of course, our legal systems do offer some protections, but the distinctive feature of the modern discussion is that the concern for specific legal rights, as I point out in the book, has really taken a front row stage. Now, of course, that's possible. Our systems can accommodate that if we choose to have them do that. Legal systems, of course, have many tools other than rights. So there's a very vibrant discussion all over the world, and there are many different legal systems. So the current legal system that we're under in the United States, for example, is just one. It's the common law system in about 30, 40 countries around the world. But there are Islamist systems, lots of indigenous legal systems. The continental Europeans have their own systems. So we find lots of different systems. Legislatively, there are an incredibly, well, you might say a wide range, David, of approaches to this generally, sometimes conferring very specific protections, other times just very generalized ones. India's constitution, for example, has a constitutional provision that calls on every citizen to protect living beings. In the United States, of course, we take quite a different approach. So the distinctive feature of the modern approach is that we started to use our big public policy mechanisms to discuss this, which, again, is a reason that we should have this issue constantly at a discussion table, working out how do we want to go forward with this important issue.
Mm-hmm. The book is framed really as a series of questions and answers, and it's a small book, and yet around this small book we could easily, I'm sure, design an entire semester's course, spending some time in depth talking about many of these things. And certainly you could do an entire course on animal law. You could do an entire course sampling the way that various philosophical schools and traditions have thought about animals and animal law. But just right off from the beginning, you, I think, have to ask this question, well, when you talk about animal rights, what actually are you talking about? And your suggestion is maybe for the purposes of the conversation that you have to set the question of maybe you have to set the question of legal rights aside, at least for a bit, because that is maybe not the more important kind of rights to be talking about.
That's a really interesting observation. It's true that when you ask about the rights of animals, you always have to ask a couple basic questions. Which adjective sits in front of the word rights? Are we talking moral rights? Those are the ones that are ancient. Legal rights, we've done a lot of things using law in the modern era, and this one we've now turned to, this question of potential legal protections for other living beings. So you always want to ask, are we talking moral rights here or legal rights? Because moral rights are much more complicated things. Legal rights are always within a specific jurisdiction, and they're usually very well defined in a particular place. And they have a very distinguished history, and we usually go get them when we want to say, this is an important topic. But moral rights, of course, is a larger category, and we have a lot of different ways of accomplishing that. We don't have to use our legal rights. I do think there are some animals which would benefit tremendously from them. I was doing an interview with NBC or CBS, perhaps, a couple years ago when I was at Yale, and the interviewer asked me, will we have legal rights? And my quick response was, yes, I think within a decade we will see some country grant specific legal rights to specific non-humans. Now, that isn't the entire case. That's not the only approach. In fact, all of us know we really have to, in our ordinary lives, as consumers, as members of a community of faith or nonprofit groups, we have to find ways in our society to protect them. We can't always rely on specific laws to control these important interactions. So the legal rights question is an important one, and many, many people are engaging this, David. But I think you're right that if you look at the larger category, it's really, are we going to use our moral abilities to put these protections into place? And if so, how often do we want to, and how often do we want to refrain from using our legal system to do that?
Mm-hmm. This, I think that you point at what is a very interesting question, something I know you've certainly have thought and written about quite a lot, and that is how we might be thinking about this, how we might be talking about this 10 years, 20 years, 30 years in the future. And I think that particularly for people who have a negative kind of evaluation of the very thing, they'll do a kind of reductio ad absurdum, and they'll draw it out to the most absurd sort of position as a way of saying, well, really, is that what we're talking about here? And can you really imagine that? But in a more kind of more sort of moderate way, as you think about, and someone who has taught courses in animal law and seen how people's thinking has developed, what do you see as where we might be with this in 20 or 30 years from now?
That's the question. I think one of the frontiers, of course, is education. You'll find that not just animal law, but a larger field called animal studies is coming to the fore. It's really astonishing to me as someone who studies this. I'm currently writing the next book in the Oxford series for me, is a book on animal studies. And you'd be astonished, David, to find how there are courses on animal issues in literature, sociology, geography, psychology, philosophy, ethics, religion, and many other subjects as well. It's overwhelming how much interest there is in the upcoming generation, and they seek classes in which they can work out these deep personal concerns. Often they're driven there because they've had experiences with a family dog or cat or with wildlife, and it's a part of, I think, really high-quality education that it responds to people's actual lives and their actual interests. So in the animal law class I teach at Harvard, students come in with a real, real interest in trying to change some of the oppressive, less than responsive laws that they know exist for a particular problem. But they quickly realize there are a lot of issues here. And to go back to your opening point, it is true. Legal systems cannot be employed in every case to solve every social problem. There are plenty of the dimensions of our interactions with other living beings that we can solve in 100 different ways. Law is just one of those. So do we want to use our legal system? Sometimes we may, sometimes we might not. But that's a matter of choice. The question is, it's up to us to choose this future. I think education is a first step. And once we're up the staircase, a few steps above, we might see some additional ones that don't appear to us right now.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, Paul Waldow, is president of the Religion and Animals Institute. For a number of years, he was director of the Center for Animals and Public Policy at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he taught ethics courses at the vet school. He's also taught at Yale Law School, at Harvard Law School, at Boston College Law School, has written a lot about this particular subject, animal rights, animal law, the relationship between human beings and animals. And his recent book explores this subject. And the title of the book is Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know. And it's published by the Oxford University Press. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. When we talk about human rights, I think the argument is made is that it is something that people have by virtue of their existence. That is, human beings as autonomous individuals have certain kinds of rights to be safe and secure in their persons, to be able to live their lives as they choose, to have some freedom of movement, and you know, a number of things would come under that heading of human rights. If you start talking about animal rights, is this something that is argued simply proceeds from the fact that they are also, to some extent, autonomous living things, and certain rights attached to that?
It's a great question. I think the answer, as my mentor used to say, is yes and no. I think it's fair to say that we all recognize how each human is a remarkable living being with internal complexities and rich possibilities for experience that we want to protect. And we use legal rights to protect those. We haven't always done that. We used to just use moral rights, and we expanded that. But legal rights are a very good tool for us, each as an individual, complicated living being with our own interests that we easily recognize. Now, there are some non-human animals that start to fall into that category, brainy, social, characterized by emotions, can handle concepts, they do thinking, rich communications of a varied sort. Those aren't all other living beings by any means, but we might put elephants and whales and dolphins and certainly chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos into that really brainy group. We might want to use those very high-level legal protections for them. But there are plenty of other living beings that don't fit into that specialized category that we clearly fit into, and we probably want some specialized kind of animal rights for them. For example, our dogs might fit here. Now, they might have emotions, and they might be able to communicate, but they're not as complicated as we are. But nonetheless, we want high-level, very effective, very fundamental protections for them. We want to use our legal systems to the extent we can, but also just our social values to develop ethics and character inside of humans so that we recognize we want to protect those individuals. So I think, David, the answer is both yes and no. There are some non-humans that we clearly could use these big, powerful legal rights for, or other amazingly effective legal protections. But a more generic kind of moral protection, a matter of our character and imagination of choosing to protect these living beings, that's often what religious traditions were talking about. Are we up to the incredibly important task of using our generosity of spirit to protect the weaker ones out there? Yes, of course we are. So I want to say that I think most of the protection will come out of the moral realm, even though we will use legal protection strategically for the most complicated of living beings, humans and non-human alike.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that as people think about animals, the more clear, or maybe it's a more challenging case, are those things that seem closest to us. Easier to make the argument for rights, more troubling when you think about often the way that they are treated. And as you get further and further down the line, then maybe they don't quite become quite so problematic. But I guess I think if the idea here is respect for living things, then, and I can't do this for myself, but I'm sure that some people would say, well, they're, you can't really draw a line anywhere, and that if you're going to take this to the point where it can go, then you're really going to say that is there really a difference between a chimpanzee and a worm? Well, there certainly is a difference between a chimpanzee and a worm. And yet, if we're going to say our basic principle is respect for living things, then maybe you have to say, well, at some level, no, there is no difference between a chimpanzee and a worm.
I think one of the important background things, and you see this in classrooms when you raise this kind of issue, because these are precisely the kinds of issues that arise. I was raised in an environment where there was definitely a line drawn. It was drawn around the human species in a kind of nominal way. All humans are supposed to be important, even though many humans weren't given those protections. And we knew, well, we've got to get a lot of humans' protections. That was one goal, and we've succeeded at that to a certain extent. We obviously have a long ways to go. But that's an important line that we want to honor, saying everybody inside the human species should get protection. We know there are some of these brainy ones just out beyond the line. We know, well, the line's problematic if it excludes those really amazing beings out there. But I wasn't educated. I wasn't raised in an educational system which alerted me to really looking at lines as carefully as we might. I think you're right. There isn't any obvious line. It's obvious that certain lines are wrong. Only white people, only males. Those lines are obviously wrong. People didn't used to think that, but we do now. I suspect that if we go 20 years into the future, 40 years into the future, we'll think, well, it's not. This line around just humans is obviously wrong. Where will we draw it? Well, each generation will be educated, I think, progressively into some more open-mindedness on this issue. We can go back several thousand years in many religious traditions and see they thought lines like that were crazy, that there were sacred features to all kinds of living beings. Just take a Christian point of view or one that you'd find in the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions. But this is God's creation. God made it sacred by creating it. Who are we to be drawing the lines like this? So there are plenty of visions whereby people begin to expand those lines, to problematize the lines they've inherited. I think that's the process we're in. But as your question, I think, quite rightly suggests, it's hard to come up with a clear, unequivocally right line. The question is, we constantly want to educate our children to say, how about this line? Do you think we can take it further? Isn't it good for us? Doesn't it create character for us? To expand the generosity of spirit that sits at our heart. And I think that's where it will go. I don't mean to avoid the question. I only mean to say I'm humbled by the fact that no one really knows where that line is. Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds as if you were saying it, at the very least what you would like. I expect you have very firm ideas how, for yourself, you draw the lines, that maybe you're less likely to tell somebody else where they want to draw their lines. But what you are saying is, what I would like you to do is to think about this and then, you know, draw your lines where you like, but have some reason for drawing them where you draw them. Do it in a conscious way, and then, okay, but at least, you know, rather than not thinking about it at all, think about it some.
Exactly on point. And in fact, I think one thing you find when you start to take a look at who's inside the moral protection system and who's outside, what you've done is invite people to consider with critical thinking skills, is this the way we want it? Lots of us grew up in worlds that were racist. We didn't want the world that way. It was up to us. It didn't matter if the people before us did it, and they said, oh, that's fine. It was up to us to say, no, that's not fine. And we can pick up any of the heavy exclusions that were characteristic of human society over the last several hundred years and say, we want to get rid of this one. It's up to us. Now, what do we do with the current lines? We think about it critically. My first class, animal law class, was at Boston College Law School, and when the evaluations came in, one of the students said to me, in the evaluation, the actual written form, the submitted to the administration, this is the class in which I learned the most about the legal system. Because what had happened in the class was people were saying, who's in, who's out, why? And they were learning to think critically about that, and that helped them see the fundamental flexibility of legal systems. And I think all education can work like that, David. We can really use our relationship to other living beings to say, who are we? What's the meaning of life? What is it that we want to do with our remarkable spirits?
Mm-hmm. I guess it seems to be the kind of thing that it's not easy to talk about. I think it makes people uncomfortable. Or maybe I should just be perfectly honest and talk about myself. Say it makes me uncomfortable. And it's not something that I like to think about a lot. I do not hold myself up as any particular paragon of virtue. I eat meat. And I wear stuff that's made out of leather. So, you know, I have no great moral ground here to stand on and tell anybody else what they should be doing. And as I said at the beginning, I guess I think that the virtue of talking about it at least is having the conversation. But that brings me back to the idea that it's not an easy thing to talk about. People don't, I think, like to think about it very much. It's better out of sight, out of mind. But do you actually think it's something that substantial numbers of people are actually willing to at least think about and examine what it is they think and try to decide, well, why it is they think that way, and is that okay with them? I mean, is it really something that that many people are willing to take on, or do you think that most people most of the time would just rather not think about it?
Well, there's certainly a segment of people who right now are not ready to think about it, and this is the kind of fundamental moral or ethical issues that each of us is on a learning curve on, and we have to come up at our own pace. Others might push us, but the truth of the matter is what each of us chooses to eat is our personal decision. In a society that allows a lot of different products to be out there, some we're going to choose and some we're going to say, no, I used to do that, but I'm not going to anymore. And I think everybody is aware that there's no, as the Buddhists would say, there's no pure land, there's no perfect solution. There are the attempts of us to live life in a meaningful way, to live as well as we can, to make choices that we take responsibility for. And people are at very different levels on that. I do have personal opinions about this, but as an educator, I'm aware my job isn't to confer my opinions on other people. It's to confer the ability to think as clearly and richly as possible using all the extraordinary range of human traits that are there, critical thinking, the ability to care, namely ethics, and the ability to listen and to be humble, and frankly, to unlearn when that's appropriate. And a lot of the answers to these fundamental questions are going to continue to change decade after decade because we've started to unlearn, gosh, we're important. But what makes us important is that we can be humble and realistic about our ability and the fact that, yes, of course we're accompanied on the earth by some other remarkable beings. We hurt them a lot. Okay, fine. We don't want to say that's okay, but what we want to say is, let's see if we can't make it better. Why not go forward in a constructive way? What world will we bequeath to our children? That kind of issue, I think, David, is our genius, not being right, not being perfect, not being all-knowing, but being humble enough to basically inquire about the world and adjust when we think, yes, that's really called for, given what those other beings we now know to be like.
Hmm. We're at our midpoint here. Let me just introduce again our guest, Paul Waldow. He's president of the Religion and Animals Institute from 2004 until 2008. He was director of the Center for Animals and Public Policy at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. He taught ethics courses there at the vet school. In 2010, he was named Barker Lecturer in Animal Law at Harvard Law School, where he first taught the course in 2002. He's also directed the Yale Law School Animal Law Reading Group, has taught courses at Boston College Law School, has authored a number of books looking at animal rights, animal law, the relationship between animals and human beings. His academic background is in philosophy and law. He's author of a recently published book. The title is Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's published by the Oxford University Press. So it's a short book, and it's in a question-and-answer format. And if you're interested in sampling the subject, it's one book that you could look at. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the subjects in the book that I think is quite interesting, and again is a big conversation in itself, is what it is we know and can know about the inner experiences of animals, particularly those that are close to us, but maybe not just those that are close to us. And I think it's one thing that's pretty striking is that within recent memory, not all that long ago, there were people, and I think even there might have been people in the vet science field, but certainly there were people who made the argument that animals didn't feel pain, which seems fairly startling when you see how they'll respond to injury. That certainly looks like they're feeling pain. But then that gets us into this interesting and difficult area of talking about, well, what is it that animals feel? Do animals feel emotions? Is there in some way their inner life like ours? And then, you know, depending on how you answer that question, then you proceed from there. But to what extent is that something that we can know, do you think?
Well, that's one of the richest, most fun topics to raise in a class. And it's worth having a lot of time, actually a lot of sessions on it, because it's not something you're going to solve in one session. I think it's fair to say you can sometimes know that something is going on in another being, but just what it is that's going on may be very elusive. Mm-hmm. So, of course, someone may conclude you can't know what that other being is thinking. Could be human, could be a non-human. But nonetheless, you could know that something is going on, that it's complicated, that it involves emotions, that it involves intelligence and reaction to something that you've done. Those are in the higher order animals with big brains, social systems, communication systems, usually mammals, some birds. And those are, we can certainly explore that. That's something that I suspect people will get much better at is if we do it as a team and we do it with humility over a very long period of time. We started that process. Our sciences are actually surprisingly good at delivering to us clear indications of things like self-awareness in a number of other animals. So that's there. There are the more elusive animals, David, like bats. There was a famous philosophical essay about what is it like to be a bat. Well, the person who wrote that, Thomas Nagel, didn't go hang around bats when he wrote it. Well, that's a little odd, isn't it? Of course, he was very good friends with an expert on bats, and he used it as a philosophical problem to say, some beings are so different from us, you just can't get a glimmer of what their life is like. Okay, fair enough. But heck, I'd want, if I was going to try to answer that question, go hang around bats for a while, maybe a long time. I think what happens is there's a really auspicious future for our studies of other living beings, namely the kind of humilities that would have us go hang around them, talk to each other, learn, unlearn, relearn, all kinds of wonderful things. And what we'll discover is there are plenty of non-human living beings whose abilities and intelligences astonish us if we will simply notice them and take them seriously.
We have a couple of callers here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. We'll start with somebody in Charleston. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank
yes.
you very much.
Yes.
I'm not sure if I couldn't formulate this in a question, but I was just hoping the guest could respond. When I did animal research in stroke, it was in Canada, one of the, I think it's an irony, truthfully, was that you choose an animal model that is close enough to the human brain. We used rats in our research of stroke to make parallels. So that we use the rat because it's just like enough like the human brain that you can make parallels with the research. But then at the same time, we say that they're not enough like us to undergo the same ethical standards. And it seems like that is an irony. I'm not sure that the ethics panels consider when they're weighing, you know, ethical considerations. And again, sorry I couldn't formulate that in a question. I just wondered if the guest could respond to that seeming irony. Thank you very much.
Sure. All right. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, you know, this is a dilemma that's been pointed out by a number of philosophers. It's raised in the book, and there are a couple passages from some of the wonderful philosophers and ethicists out there, Bernard Rolin, Daniel Dennett, a number of others who have said, gosh, they're so like us that we can experiment on them to learn about ourselves, but they're so unlike us that we don't have to treat them with any kind of respect. And you think, well, that at least on its face should raise questions for any sensitive being. Well, what's interesting is the science establishment just passes that away as if, oh, come on, that's a foolish question. No, it's not. It's a natural question. It's the kind of question you want young people who are trying to figure out, what do I do with these ethical abilities that I was born with? You want them to ask that question. And in fact, in that question is much more power than the answer. namely the power to ask, to use our big human brains to start exploring those kinds of questions. Now, that's a wonderful question by the caller, because what it does is underscore, gosh, they're so like us that we can experiment on them and learn about our brains, our big, amazing human brains we can learn about from other living beings. In fact, rat models have probably produced the most information about human physiology and psychology of any living beings. That means we live in an integrated universe. What do we want to do with that? We inherited a system whereby we got to experiment on them. Okay, that's the law. Is that what we want? Let's make a choice and have an open debate, not a shutdown debate where somebody says, I have a lot of money invested in this and you can't take it away from me. No. What is it that we want to do in terms of going forward? That scares people, David. I know that scares people to hear that. That's not the point. The point is, let's be as fully human with all our entire panorama of abilities. Let's let people bring those to the table and openly discuss them. We are naturally connected to these other beings. Historically, lots of animal advocates have protected lots of humans. Just look it up. It's an amazing piece of information. And there is something encouraging about us coming of age and learning to respect all kinds of life. That only is a better world for our kids to live in. So the point here is, those kinds of questions have an amazing power well beyond the actual answer to the question.
All right, let's go to, I want to take the call. Let's go to someone else here. This is Champagne in line one. Hello.
Hi. I have a number of points I want to bring up, and I'll let you pick and choose in them. First, the idea of limiting the relatedness and whatever behavioral limitations you want to set to animals is strange, given that we know very well that trees are alive. They're different life than us, but they're alive, and they respond to life, and there are lots of other beings. So part of this is coming from the fact that you privileged things like mental processes and emotions. Is that a good basis on which to make decisions? So that's the first set of questions. I want to go several steps further. The fact that in various, we'll call it ancient times, humans treated animals as part of the sacred life did not mean that they did not eat them or kill them and so forth, but rather they treated the fact that life is life and death, is killing, and that's part of this whole process of being alive, is that there's going to be sickness and there's going to be old age, there's going to be death and there's going to be killing. But they worked on ways to work within that and honor it and yet still do it. Because what I hear you saying is you want to set up these rules and somehow impose them, whether with laws or otherwise, telling people what they should or shouldn't do. So that's another set of issues that I think needs to be looked at. The other aspect is that you are saying that it's better, and better in whatever way, for people not to, let's say, hunt. But you say they will maybe someday come to that. If we look at human society, that might be one theme in human society, but we could also look at large segments of human society, whether we look at, let's say, Chinese culture, where not only do they hunt and kill, but they kill all sorts of animals and use them to eat and so forth, that we in the West think is very strange. If we look at African culture, we see that, sadly, all sorts of primates are treated as food. So if we say we're better, they haven't reached our level of civilization yet, it seems to me that that's a very skewed way of looking at the world. I think we have to recognize that what you're talking about reflects a certain type, a certain aspect of Western culture that's prominent now in the 19th and 20th century, but is far from, quote, the best human. Now, I'll take one step further. From a Buddhist point of view, since you raised Buddhist point of view, not only is it that humans and other living beings that you think of as animals are considered part of this, I'll use the word Buddha nature, but also trees and rocks and rivers, and all of those need to be respected and treated respectfully. Okay, I'll stop there and listen on there, see what you have to say about any of that.
All right.
Well, a rich set of questions. Let me take the last one first. There are many cultural views among humans, and it is the caller's right. There have been a remarkable range of valuations that have included certainly trees and rocks and some. There's absolutely wonderful material. And to some extent, the book deals with the fact that indigenous points of view are extremely important inputs in the way that the entire human family goes forward. So I don't want to come across as suggesting that the Western approach is the only one. If you go back to this question about sacredness of animals but still hunting them, the people who held animals sacred would find that what we do in terms of our confinement agriculture to be an ugly reality that contradicts our moral nature. And I think in that sense, the sacredness of the animals led to certain kinds of respect, although it didn't. It certainly allowed them to hunt, but there can be tremendous respect for living beings allowed to live freely, but you hunt them for your subsistence needs. Those are not at all inconsistent. Caller raised an interesting question about which behaviors will we privilege, will we recognize. In terms of setting public policy in a democratic society, one of the things you have to do is appeal to the public. I may have my own personal points of view, but if I want to say we ought to have laws on something or we ought to have ethical developments that we don't have now, I have to go out to the public and get people to agree to that. And one of the things you have to do is appeal to what they recognize. We live in an environment where intelligence is privileged, so are emotions, and that's one of the reasons those arguments get made. But it is clearly the case that many cultures have not had to have those bases for respecting a phenomenon. They could respect it they could respect trees fully, as often happened, or all kinds of landscape, etc. Now, the point is that there are lots of opportunities. The caller makes a point that's extremely important, is a lot of our reasoning patterns are fairly limited right now, and there are many more available to us. That's the reason for the discussion, to open up people's consideration of that. That's why the discussion goes differently in Japan, differently in Australia, differently in India, differently in Brazil than it does here. And each culture has to rely on its own lights, its own insights to move forward. In the United States, we have a lot of production, a lot of economics drive what we make decisions. We also are very interested in science and intelligence, et cetera. Those are the terms that play out here, but other cultures are different. So I think if we go 100 years, maybe we'll play it differently. And I hope we see that kind of that variety, because that's the kind of thing that suggests we really are as open-minded as we sometimes claim we are.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Paul Waldow. He's president of the Religion and Animals Institute, taught for a number of years at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he served as director of the Center for Animals and Public Policy. He also was in 2002, 2006, 2008, 2010, served as the Bob Barker Lecturer on Animal Law at Harvard Law School, and also has taught at Yale Law School and Boston College Law School. His book, the book that we're talking about here, one of a number of books that he's written, is Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know, and it is published by the Oxford University Press. Questions, again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wanted to go back just for a moment to talk a little bit more about the use of animals in research. And ask a question that, again, is one of those questions I'm sure is asked in classrooms, and it's great for at least for conversation. If we make the argument that human beings have, that it is of benefit to human beings to do biomedical and maybe even psychological research, and then in the past we've used animals to do that, and maybe we want to think differently about that, would you make the argument, or at least encourage people to think about this question, if we think that that's of benefit to human beings, should we be willing to use human beings as our research subjects?
I do think the best, let's talk just sort of scientific philosophy. The best research subjects are inside the same species as the species that you're trying to inquire about. No one would deny that. There are important biological reasons for that. I don't in any way advocate researching on humans in order to get ahead in our knowledge for humans. I think humans are wonderfully important beings. I treasure them, and I want to do as much as I can in my life to help us solve our disease problems, social problems, etc. But I don't think that comes that brings me to the conclusion that we get to experiment on humans. The reason for that is I think those that are experimented on suffer. I personally believe that. I think that's also true of non-humans. That's also why I problematize experimentation on other living beings when it harms them in any way. I also think we're big-brained enough, and we have in the offing all sorts of techniques, in vitro work, all sorts of interesting data mining, all sorts of wonderful techniques by which we can do very important cutting-edge research without having to use whole living beings that have to suffer by virtue of that research. So I think, David, the answer to that is living beings are important to me. I'm not going to license experimentation on living beings that suffer from experimentation simply because we can get ahead. I think that's a very dangerous place. It also causes us to stop looking for the alternatives because we're remarkable and we can find those alternatives. We have to fund them. We have to push. They may come more slowly. They may come more quickly. I don't know the answer to that, but the point is I think we should push for those because I think research is vitally important.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. Here's another caller, someone on a cell phone. We'll go there, line one. Hello.
Hi, this is Sarah Folks-Miller. I am a swine vet, and I work in the pork industry. And I just wanted to comment briefly and talk to our listeners about how strongly we as folks who work in the pork industry take our role seriously about providing good animal care for the pigs that we have the opportunity to work with. And I heard you made some fairly strong comments against units that you referred to as confinement units. I just want to reassure folks that, you know, our focus is to provide good clean air, a warm place for those pigs to be, and for us to provide ample food, water, and individual pig care. And so I enjoyed your communication where you spoke about openness, humility, and I think that there are folks in the agricultural community who are working very hard to think through some of these issues and figure out what is the best way to provide for the animals under our care, and we take our jobs very seriously. So I just wondered if you had any additional comments that might speak to reflecting openness and humility in regards to that issue. Thank you. I'll take my answer offline.
All right.
Well, thank you for the question. I have a different point of view here, but I want to say how in an animal studies class, an animal ethics class, an animal law class, that kind of question is important to put on the table and have discussed openly. When I teach, I don't tell people what my values are. They may pick it up from how I speak, but my point is to facilitate discussion, so having that question is a good thing. My personal response to that is that I hope vets will always try to maximize the welfare of the animals under their care. And to the extent the caller feels consistent that that's being done, great, because that's a wonderful general instinct. I want to take it further, of course. I think the sense of animal welfare for animals confined in big modern production facilities is an extremely minor sense of animal welfare. We often have rather minor changes that we make that improve their lives a bit, but end up leaving intact rather horrific forms of suffering ultimately. And for me, I think I don't really want to live in that world, so I'm not going to consume in a way that perpetuates that. But I recognize in my society that the law not only permits that, it encourages that sort of production. And I have to, as a member of the democratic society, first of all, keep that forefronted in the discussion, and secondly, deal with the fact that there are people of integrity who hold that position, even if I want to say, gosh, I don't, and I'm not really sure how you do that, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt there. So I hope there's enough humility in that answer, but also enough strength to say, I think there's a different vision we can live by.
I think that probably people now who've been listening to you over the last 50 minutes would say that they think they know how you feel about these particular issues, even though you haven't in a very direct way said, well, this is what I think should be. Let me ask you directly, are you a vegetarian?
I'm a vegan.
You're a vegan. So you you go all the way on that.
I try. Well, I think, David, the best way to say that is I try to be a vegan. I work at it, but I don't pretend that if I'm a vegan, I've solved all the problems. What happens when I eat soy products that are trucked to me across the country, and in that process, some animals die? Am I not part of that? Yes, of course I am. It's not an easy situation. For me, eating vegan is a wonderful exploration, and I enjoy it, but I don't ever want to sit up and pretend that because I eat vegan that somehow I've got a moral leg up on someone else. I think, well, what's their circumstance? And for me, I want each person to be able to inquire and have the freedoms that I have in that sense. So I usually like to say that I try to eat vegan because I'm very close to actually being a full vegan, but there are plenty of other things. I drive a car. What damage do I cause from that? Okay. All of us live in ways that we can get better, and I appreciate the vet's question because she works in a context in which efforts she makes can actually improve individual lives. Go for it.
We're just at the point where we have to stop. Without having really an answer other than, I hope, as I said at the beginning, it's given people something to think about. What sort of thought would you like to leave with the people who are listening?
We are capable of choosing our future. We can use the legal systems as we please, our religious systems as we please, to help others. Who would the others be? For me, the question is a very broad and wonderful one that only underscores how we're at our best when we're at our most humble about answering that question and trying to help as many others, human and otherwise, as we can.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. As I said a couple of times here, our guest, Paul Waldow, is president of the Religion and Animals Institute. If you'd like to find out more about that, they have a website. You can take a look at it. He has taught at Tufts University School of Vet Medicine. He was director of the Center for Animals and Public Policy there at Tufts. He's also taught for a number of years at Harvard. He was in 2002, 2006, 2008, 2010, the Bob Barker Lecturer on Animal Law at Harvard Law School. He's also taught at Yale Law School and Boston College Law School. And if you're interested in exploring this issue, you can take a look at his book, Animal Rights, What Everyone Needs to Know. It is published by the Oxford University Press. Dr. Waldow, thank you very much for talking with us today.
David, thank you. Thanks to Harriet and to Celeste as well. I really appreciate the honor of coming. Thank you.
WILL programs are made possible by The Spice Box, a student-run restaurant in Bevere Hall. Special dining events begin Friday, January 28th, and continue on Wednesdays and Fridays through May 4th. Reservations are required. More information is available at www.spicebox.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
That's it for us on Focus. We have much more news, other things coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine and the host of that show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. We're online at will.illinois.edu. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at $8.74.5, up 14.5. May, $8.85, up 14.25. In Chicago, March wheat, $7.90.75, up 17.5. May, $8.19.25. That is up 16.25. March corn, $6.58.75, up 10. May, $6.67.75, up 9.75. July, $6.71.75, up 9.5. September, $6.14.25, up 4.75. March beans, $4.16.75, down 5.75. May, $14.26.5, down 4.75. July, $14.31.25, down 3.5. August, $14.02.75, down 1.25. March meal, $3.83.60 down $4.50. March oil, $57.53. That's up 26. February live cattle, 110.15, up 77.5. April, 114.62.5, up 87.5. January feeder cattle, 128.15, up 2.55. March, 128.85, up 155. February lean hogs, 86.